are the felons convicted of breaking into the Capitol on January 6th hostages or patriots, as President-elect Trump has said repeatedly? Do you agree with his characterization?
I am not familiar with that statement, Senator.
I just familiarized you with that statement. Do you agree with that statement?
I'm not familiar with it, Senator.
No answer. He has also said illegal immigration is poisoning the blood of our nation. Do you agree with that statement?
Senator, I am not familiar with that statement.
Who won the 2020 presidential election?
Joe Biden is the president of the United States.
Ms. Bondi, you know that there is a difference between acknowledging it and, you know, I can say that Donald Trump won the 2024 election. I may not like it, but I can say it. You cannot say who won the 2020 presidential election. It's disturbing.
Yes, it's disturbing. Prepare to be disturbed, America.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yes, I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A. Also elsewhere in California, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Hawaii, Ohio, New York, Louisiana, New Mexico, New Hampshire, Arkansas, Washington State, Virginia, West Virginia, Wisconsin, and Minnesota, not to mention a whole bunch of streaming websites and podcast sites blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. As you can tell, well, we knew it was going to be a busy day today with six confirmation hearings all at once in the U.S. Senate, along with our opportunity today to speak with an expert on the Donald Trump sentencing in his New York criminal case that finally took place last Friday to discuss what, if anything, that means, not to mention the ongoing fires out here in Los Angeles. But now, with the news out of Israel and Gaza on Wednesday afternoon, things have become even busier than planned. So we'll do our best to get to as much as we can today. As noted, following the extraordinary, and I might say extraordinarily disastrous, Senate confirmation hearing for Donald Trump's completely unqualified nominee to be Secretary of Defense on Tuesday. That would be Fox News host, accused sexual assaulter, public drunkard, and longtime opponent of women in the military, Pete Hegseth, on Tuesday in the U.S. Senate Armed Services Committee. I might say that that was extraordinarily disastrous, as you heard on this program yesterday, but for the fact that the compliant Republicans on the committee in the Senate made it clear they do not care about Hegseth's complete lack of qualifications for that job and his multitude, frankly, of disqualifications for the role, leading the largest organization and most lethal military in the world, as head of the 3 million employees strong Pentagon and the American war machine. Because even Senator Joni Ernst, Republican of Iowa, who's both a veteran and a sexual assault survivor herself, and at least until now a champion for other sexual assault survivors, shortly after we got off the air yesterday, she formally announced that, yes, she would be voting for Hegseth and his confirmation, despite a multitude of allegations against the guy, including for alleged rape and a woman that he paid off to keep her quiet about those allegations. So, yeah, seems like Republicans in Congress are pretty much ready to roll over for anything and everything for Donald Trump at this point. On Wednesday, six different Senate committee nomination oversight hearings were carried out, largely all at almost the exact same time, making it impossible for the media or the public to oversee any of them, or at least all of them. That was clearly the point of doing it that way, I would think. facing confirmation hearings on Wednesday, where former MTV Road Rules TV star and Congressman Sean Duffy, as Trump's pick to be Secretary of Transportation, former Texas Congressman John Ratcliffe to be CIA director, Florida Senator Marco Rubio for Secretary of State, natural gas company CEO and climate change denier Chris Wright to head up the Energy Department, Russell Vogt to a key architect of the Project 2025 to be Trump's nominee for director of the Office of Management and Budget, and Trump impeachment lawyer Pam Bondi for U.S. Attorney General, taking the role originally given to former congressman and accused child sex trafficker Matt Gaetz. We will have to we'll get to a bit more on Bondi's hearing today momentarily, but we've got some apparently good news, I think, to report out of the Middle East today. The news on this has sort of been breaking all day, going back and forth. Is it happening? Is it not happening? Has Israel's Benjamin Netanyahu accepted the deal, etc.? So this is all still extremely delicate, it seems to me, as if it could change, fall apart at any time before it actually happens. But if it does happen, well, here is the latest as we go to air, according to the according to AP now at this hour. Israel and Hamas have agreed to a ceasefire deal to pause the devastating war in the Gaza Strip, multiple officials announced on Wednesday, raising the possibility of winding down the deadliest and most destructive fighting between the bitter enemies. The deal promises the release of dozens of hostages held by Hamas in phases and hundreds of Palestinian prisoners being held in Israel, and it will allow hundreds of thousands of people displaced in Gaza to finally return to, well, whatever remains of their homes. Critically, the deal would also flood badly needed humanitarian aid into a territory ravaged by 15 months of horrific war. The Prime Minister of Qatar announced the ceasefire would go into effect this Sunday. He made the announcement in the Qatari capital of Doha, the site of weeks of painstaking negotiations, months, in fact. U.S. President Joe Biden then touted the deal from Washington, crediting months of, quote, dogged and painstaking American diplomacy for landing the deal, saying the ceasefire will take place, will stay in place as long as Israel and Hamas remain at the negotiating table over a long-term truce, while noting that his administration and President-elect Donald Trump's team had been, quote, speaking as one in the latest negotiations. Now, a spokesperson for Trump's team had said the same thing in recent days, that they were participating along with the Biden team. I found that to be encouraging, as that negotiator actually lauded the efforts by the Biden team, surprisingly enough. Jonathan Panikoff, director of the Scowcroft Middle East Security Initiative at the Atlantic Council, noted, quote, the ironic reality is that at a time of heightened partisanship, even over foreign policy, the deal represents how much more powerful and influential U.S. foreign policy can be when it is bipartisan. Now, the office of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, he's clearly the wild card here. He said, they said in a statement that the final details were still being ironed out and that it hoped, quote, details will be finalized tonight. I hope so, too, but we will see. I remain cautious. An Israeli official said those details center on confirming the list of Palestinian prisoners who are to be freed. Any agreement must ultimately be approved by Netanyahu's cabinet, so that too could still be a stumbling block here. But the news at this hour, anyway, remains hopeful. Israeli President Yitzhak Herzog called on Netanyahu's government to approve the ceasefire in a nationally televised speech. Hamas said in a statement that the ceasefire was, quote, the result of the legendary resilience of our great Palestinian people and our valiant resistance in the Gaza Strip. Once the deal officially begins, if it does, hopefully by Sunday, it's expected to deliver an initial 6-week halt to fighting that is said to be accompanied by the opening of negotiations on ending the war altogether. Over those 6 weeks, 33 of the nearly 100 hostages are to be reunited with their loved ones after months in captivity with no contact with the outside world. It's unclear, however, if all of them are actually alive. It remained unclear exactly when and how many displaced Palestinians would be able to return to what remains of their homes and whether the agreement would lead to a complete end to the war and the full withdrawal of Israeli troops from Gaza. Many longer-term questions, of course, about post-war Gaza remain, including who will rule the territory or oversee the daunting task of reconstruction after a brutal conflict that has destabilized the broader Middle East and sparked worldwide protests. Hamas triggered the war with its October 2023 cross-border attack, which killed some 1,200 Israelis and took 250 others hostage. Israel responded with a fierce offensive that has killed more than 46,000 Palestinians, including militants, but mostly women and children, according to local health officials. It has displaced an estimated 90% of Gaza's population, sparked a humanitarian crisis that has led to investigation by the International Court of Justice, or ICJ, into allegations that that Israel has committed genocide in this war, and arrest warrants issued by the International Criminal Court, or ICC, that's a separate body, also in The Hague, arrest warrants for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his defense minister, and a Hamas commander for war crimes and crimes against humanity linked to the war. So, potentially, very good news for a lot of people today if this deal holds up and if this indeed happens soon, beginning by Sunday, as currently announced, the day before Donald Trump is sworn in as the next president of the United States and the first to be sworn in as a convicted felon. Talk more about that in a bit. But on that score, as mentioned, with the few minutes that we have before being joined by my guest, with all of the confirmation hearings for Trump nominees happening in the Senate on Wednesday, Desi Doyen, I know you've been doing your best to follow both Trump's pick of fossil fuel CEO Chris Wright as the new Energy Department Secretary and Trump loyalist and impeachment lawyer Pam Bondi to be the next Attorney General of the United States. We'll need to kick the Chris Wright can down the road for the moment, unfortunately, but with our truncated time today, what were your takeaways today from Pam Bondi's confirmation hearing in the Senate Judiciary Committee?
Well, overall, Senate Democrats have three areas of their focus. Number one, will you keep the Justice Department independent from political influence? Things like, you know, whether she'll investigate Trump's perceived political enemies like Jack Smith and Liz Cheney. Second, asking...
Investigate or target, I suspect is a better word there, but go ahead.
Okay. Second, asking her to affirm that Donald Trump did lose the 2020 election, which she refused to do. And three,
over and over again.
Yeah, it was rather comical.
Who won the 2020 election? And she would just say over and over again, Joe Biden is the president.
Right. And
straight off of Fox News, man, that's how they do this. Incoming attorney general would not even say that Joe Biden won the presidency.
Exactly.
Four years later.
And third, whether she would support Trump's claims that he will issue blanket pardons, including the violent felons from the January 6th insurrection. So Republicans, on their part, you know, they aired their usual grievances, their, you know, previously debunked assertions that falsely claim that the Justice Department has been, investigating Trump's wrongdoing, and that is weaponization.
He's weaponized the Justice Department.
Yeah, except, of course, when it comes to the Justice Department investigating people like Hunter Biden, for example.
Right. And the senator from New Jersey, the Democratic senator from New Jersey, whose name I already forgot, who was indicted and convicted.
Menendez.
And the mayor of New York City, the Democratic mayor of New York City, who's been indicted. So other than that, they totally weaponized it against Republicans.
Yeah. And so her denials and refusals to answer came out like in various word salad ways. And when she was asked about Trump's public threats to use the DOJ to go after his enemies, she avoided answering by saying things like, she's not familiar with those statements, or I won't answer questions about hypotheticals.
Uh-huh.
So this exchange with her and now Senator Adam Schiff from California, that gives you a sense of how it went.
Ms. Bondi, as you know, The Supreme Court in Trump versus United States held the president has absolute immunity to commit crimes in certain core areas of the president's responsibility. One of those core areas is the Justice Department. So in a breathtakingly dangerous and irresponsible decision, Justice Roberts and the majority held the president can commit crimes using the Department of Justice and be immune from prosecution. Justice Sotomayor correctly said this new immunity lies about like a loaded weapon. So the fear and the concern we have is that the incoming president will use that loaded weapon, that immunity, to commit crimes through the Department of Justice. And for that reason, it is all the more important that we have an attorney general who has the independence, the strength, the intestinal fortitude to say no to the president when it is necessary. So my first set of questions has to do whether you have the independence to say no when you must say no. And you can say this is hypothetical, but it is not hypothetical. So let me start with one very specific non-hypothetical. The president has said Jack Smith should go to jail. Will you investigate Jack Smith?
Senator, I haven't seen the file. I haven't seen the investigation. I haven't looked at anything. It would be irresponsible of me to make a commitment regarding anything without you're a long practicing attorney without looking at a file.
So you would need a factual predicate to open an investigation of Jack Smith, is that right?
Not a summary by you sitting here. Yes, sir.
And not a summary by the president either, right?
Absolutely.
So a summary by the president or his desire to investigate Jack Smith would not be enough for you to open an investigation of Jack Smith. Is that right?
I will look at the facts and evidence in any case. You know,
and
72%,
sitting here today.
Senator, 72% of Americans have lost faith in the Department of Justice.
Sitting here today, are you aware of any factual predicate to investigate Jack Smith? Sitting here today, yes or no?
Senator, I will look at the facts and the circumstances.
You can't answer that question.
Brought to me.
You're not a part of the department yet. There's no worry about divulging law enforcement sensitive information. So just tell us. Are you aware of a factual predicate to investigate Jack Smith? Yes or no?
Senator, what I'm hearing on the news
are
is
you
horrible.
Aware of a,
Do I know
you,
if he committed a crime?
Reluctant.
I have not looked
You seem
at.
Reluctant to answer a simple question. Let me ask you a different simple question. The president also wants to jail Liz Cheney. Sitting here today, are you aware of any factual basis to investigate Liz Cheney? Yes or no?
Senator, that's a hypothetical, and I'm not going to answer
that
question.
No, it's not hypothetical. I'm asking you, sitting here today, whether you are aware of a factual predicate to investigate Liz Cheney.
Senator, no one
Based
has
on
asked
you
me
know.
To investigate Liz Cheney. That is a hypothetical.
The president has called for it publicly. You are aware of that, aren't you?
No one has asked me to investigate.
But the president
Liz.
Has
We're
called,
also worried
the president,
about Liz Cheney,
the
Senator.
President has
you
called
know what
for
we should
this,
be worried about?
Ms. Bondi,
the
please answer my questions.
Crime rate in California
questions.
Right now
you
is
are aware,
through the roof.
Ms. Bondi,
your
my,
robberies
Ms. Bondi,
are 87%
question,
higher than the national average.
My question
average.
Is this.
That's what I
my
want to be focused
is this.
On, Senator.
Do you have the power to say no to the president?
General.
And what you're suggesting today by your non-answer is you don't have the independence to say no to the president. So let me ask you a different question. It also requires you, if you're going to be a good attorney general, to be able to tell hard truths to the president. So my questions now are, can you tell hard truths to the president? So let me start with an easy truth that you could speak to the president. Can you tell us, can you tell him that Donald Trump lost the 2020 election? Can you say that? Do you have the independence to say that? Do you have the gravitas, the stature, the intestinal fortitude to say, Donald Trump, you lost the 2020 election? Can you tell us that here today?
Senator, what I can tell you is I will never play politics. You're trying to engage me in a gotcha. I
no,
won't
I'm just
do
asking
it.
You a simple
I
question.
Won't play
if
politics
you can speak truth
with any ongoing
to power. So let me ask you another.
Like you did leaking Devin Nunes' memo.
If you can't answer the question, let me ask you a different, what should be a simple truth, not a hard one. Was there massive fraud affecting the result of the 2020 election, yes or no?
Senator, I'm glad you asked that question, if you'll let me answer what I saw in Pennsylvania.
No, I asked a simple question about massive fraud.
I can only tell you what I saw in Pennsylvania.
No, I know you want to answer a different question, but my question is, Can you tell us whether there was massive fraud affecting the results of the 2020 election, yes or no? Was there or was there not?
I can tell you what I saw when I went
as
an advocate to the campaign.
That's not my question. So you can't answer that question. You can't speak that even easy truth to us, let alone to the president. So let me ask you a different question. It will also be important that you give good advice to the president. Are you prepared to advise the president not to pardon people who beat police officers?
Senator, as I said, the pardons are at the direction of the president. We will look and we will advise. I will look at every case on a case.
Okay, so
let me finish. On a case-by-case basis.
Okay, good.
I abhor violence to police officers.
Follow up with that. So will it be your advice to the president? Mr. President, I know you said you want to issue hundreds of pardons on day one. Will it be your advice to the president? No, Mr. President, I need to go over them on a case-by-case basis. Do not issue blanket pardons. Will that be your advice to the president?
Senator, I have not looked at any of those files. If confirmed, I will look at the files
and
for
will
the
you
pardons
be able to do,
as well
will
as
you
the
be able to review hundreds of cases on day one?
I will look at every file I am asked to look at.
Of course you won't. So will you advise the president?
Can I answer the question?
Well, my question
I would have plenty of staff. You said, of course you won't.
You'll be able to review hundreds of cases on the first day?
I'm not going to mislead this body, nor you.
All right, let me ask another question. You don't want to answer that. Let me ask another question.
You were censured by Congress, Senator, for comments just like this that are so reckless.
It will also be important for you to be able to preserve the records, the evidence of the department. Are you ready to commit that none of the evidence in the January 6th investigation will be destroyed under your watch?
Senator, I will follow the law. I will consult with ethical officials in the department.
Do you see any ethical basis to destroy evidence in the January 6th investigation? Then why can't you answer the question? Why can't you say, I commit to this committee, we will never destroy the evidence in the January 6th investigation? Why can't you give this committee and the American people that assurance?
Are you frightened because evidence was destroyed against President Trump that was false? Is that why you're frightened
now? Why do you have difficulty answering that question?
I can't believe
why do you have difficulty promising to preserve evidence at the Department of Justice? Why is that a difficult question?
I will follow the law.
It shouldn't be a difficult question.
Again, that was Pam Bondi, the former Florida Attorney General, at her confirmation hearing on Wednesday in the Senate Judiciary Committee, being questioned by now Senator Adam Schiff of California about whether she can remain independent if she is confirmed as Attorney General. And based on what I saw at the hearing, it does appear that she will be confirmed, that the Democrats do not have the votes to prevent it.
I should also note, by the way, she was a donee. She's received money from Donald Trump back when she was attorney general in Florida, and she was investigating his Trump University fraud, or said to be looking at that. And suddenly she decided to not look into that after he made a donation to her campaign.
Exactly.
So combative. To say the least.
She wasn't like that with Republicans.
Really?
Yeah.
Were they asking her questions like they asked Pete Hegseth? How many push-ups can you do?
Oh, they were not.
She was playing that Sergeant Schultz defense quite a bit throughout the testimony that I saw. I've seen nothing. I know nothing. I've seen nothing. One question was, you know, do you agree he was breaking the law when he asked the Georgia Secretary of State on that phone call to find 11,000 votes to help him steal the Georgia election? She said she hadn't heard that. She hadn't actually heard about that phone call.
She only heard short pieces. Yeah. She didn't hear the whole thing, yeah. So she could not
comment on that at all.
And, you know, it is very important, not just for the elements that were covered by Adam Schiff on that exchange, but also because, remember, the DOJ must be independent because it is also critical for enforcement of voting rights laws and election administration laws.
Independent. That is darling, Donald Trump. Independent DOJ. Okay, well, let me ask my guest about that in a little bit here. Let's take a quick break here, and because I want to talk about Donald Trump's criminal felony sentencing last week in New York and what, if anything, that now means now that he will be sworn in as the first felon to ever take office as president of the United States. Former federal prosecutor Randall Eliason is back with us next to discuss that on the broadcast on another busy day. Yes, still in the Trump era. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't touch that dial.
Hey, this is Desi. The Bradcast and the Green News Report survive thanks to you and your support. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate today to help us stay independent every day over your public airwaves. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Yeah, it is good. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Just before Thanksgiving, former federal prosecutor Randall D. Eliason joined us on this program to discuss his article at the time in The Atlantic headlined, Trump's New York Sentencing Must Proceed, arguing that, quote, an election is not a jury verdict and winning an election does not make you any less guilty. At the time, I believe it was just about 10 days after Trump won the 2024 election, Eliason opined, quote, one of the many troubling consequences of Donald Trump's re-election is that he will largely avoid responsibility for his conduct in his four criminal cases. No other criminal defendant in American history has had the power to shut down his own prosecution. This is an unprecedented and wrenching affront to the principle that no one is above the law. But, as he went on to observe, quote, the potential exception is the New York State case, the one where a jury found Trump guilty of 34 felony counts related to falsifying business records to cover up hush money payments to the adult film star Stormy Daniels prior to the 2016 election. Yes, to cheat in that one. Once in office, Eliason wrote, Trump may cancel federal prosecutions of himself and his allies. He may seek to bend the justice system to his will in unprecedented ways. But that doesn't mean the New York District Attorney or the judge in the case, Justice Juan Merchan, should obey in advance by abandoning the jury's state verdict. Trump should be sentenced, Eliason argued, quote, even if Trump ends up with no substantial sentence, that's an important legal and historical statement, he said. The people have spoken, as Trump's attorneys and supporters would say, according to Randall, but just as Trump's criminal cases did not prevent his re-election, the election should not prevent the regular criminal process in New York from concluding this sentencing must proceed. That was before Thanksgiving, and, well, that sentencing did proceed, mostly. As you hopefully know by now, last Friday, after last-minute desperate emergency appeals to both the High Court in New York and to his friends on the U.S. Supreme Court, Trump argued that a president-elect was somehow immune from prosecution, so the case must be dropped. But after those last-minute appeals had failed, Trump's sentencing for his 34 felony criminal counts, for which he was found unanimously guilty by a jury, was in fact carried out. Allowed to appear in court remotely via Zoom from Mar-a-Lago in Florida, he was sentenced to an unconditional discharge, which means, as I understand it, he receives no punishment for his crimes, other than the mark on his criminal record that he is, in fact, a felon and will now be officially sworn in on January 20th as the first felon to ever become president of the United States. Is that what Randall Eliason was hoping for, or at least calling for? I don't know. Let's ask him. Randall D. Eliason is the former chief of the Fraud and Public Corruption Section at the U.S. Attorney's Office for the District of Columbia. He now teaches white-collar criminal law at George Washington University Law School and contributes to a number of publications, including his own sidebarsblog.com newsletter. Counselor Eliason, welcome back to the broadcast, sir.
Thank you. Happy New Year.
Thank you, and to you, sir. So over the weekend, in your Sidebars newsletter, you described the long-awaited sentencing last Friday of Donald Trump as a, quote, small victory for the rule of law. Was it? And if so, how so?
Yeah. Well, look, nobody's happy about this outcome, I think it's fair to say, right? Certainly Trump's supporters aren't happy about it. They thought the case never should have been brought in the first place. And those of us on the other side who thought the case was appropriate, it feels like this is just another example of him kind of being above the law, right? He got away with something. He got this super lenient punishment that an ordinary person would not get. He's just skated the justice system one more time. And by virtue of being reelected. And there's some truth in all that. The only thing I can say in response, and the reason I said it's a small, emphasis on small, victory, is that it's given the situation we were in after the election, this is the least bad option. This is sort of the best thing we could hope for, I think, because the alternatives were worse, right? There was a decent chance that the case got thrown out completely. That could have happened. He was one vote away in the Supreme Court from having the sentencing postponed, you know, potentially indefinitely, maybe 4 years or more, and who knows what would have happened in the interim there. So he never got sentenced. And what happened instead, and thanks in large part to Judge Merchan's kind of skillful handling of the case, he was sentenced. He was that's the final act in a criminal case. He's sentenced, that finalizes the conviction. He's a convicted felon, that is on his record. And that's an important statement for history. It's an important statement for the legal system to say, yes, this case was concluded and you were found guilty and now that's been formalized. And it's clearly an important thing to Trump because he fought mightily to try to avoid it happening, right? So to people who say it's kind of meaningless, I think the response to that is, look how hard Trump tried to avoid having it happen. He doesn't think it's meaningless, right? So even in the absence of a meaningful sentence, I do think that given both the election results and the Supreme Court's immunity decision and the posture where we are now, and when you look at the other three criminal cases, this was sort of the best thing we could hope for.
You described Justice Merchan as doing a, quote, masterful job in your piece over the weekend, both during the trial and in the post-conviction maneuverings to finally get the case to this point. And I agree, at least up to the very end, which I'll have some questions about in a second. But as someone who understands how judges succeed and or fail in cases like this, what made his oversight of this case masterful, in your opinion?
Well, I think all throughout the trial, there were just many, many instances where he was called upon to rule upon, you know, certain legal objections and evidentiary matters and things like that. And from the outside, anyway, it appeared to me that he was doing a great job, having been before a lot of judges. I don't think Trump is likely to get this case thrown out based on some ruling that Judge Merchan made about what evidence to let in, what evidence to exclude, things like that. He handled all that stuff really well. He put up with Trump's, insults and assaults on him and on the court system, both kind of inside and outside the courtroom.
Which
held
by the way,
contempt a couple of times.
Yeah. Which, by the way, nobody has ever seen. I mean, have you ever seen your career as a prosecutor someone attack the judge and the judge's family and the prosecutors in the way that this guy did throughout?
No.
It's just not done.
No, it's just not done. You end up, you know, locked up. I mean, and Merchan bent over backwards, you know, finding him in contempt and fining him and you know, that to some point the contempt sanction sort of stuck, right? You heard Trump say repeatedly, "Oh, I'm under a gag order, you know, I can't talk about it," but you know, that meant he wasn't actually talking about it at least as much as he had been, in terms of at least attacking the jurors and the prosecutors and things like that. But and then towards the end, there was this flurry of motions in November and December, you know, dismiss the case entirely because of presidential immunity, because of the election, and because of all the mistakes in the trial, postpone it, you know, indefinitely. And he reasoned through all of that, denied those motions, did it quickly enough that there was time for appeals before January 20th. Mm-hmm. And then when he denied Trump's final motion, he signaled in that order Look, given the current situation and the fact that he's won the election and he's going to take office here, it seems like the only reasonable sentence is going to be this unconditional discharge. And that ended up being in the Supreme Court in its ridiculously close 5-4 decision, which should have never been 5-4.
Yep.
They mentioned that. They said, you know, one reason they denied Trump's request for a stay is that the judge has basically said the likely sentence is an unconditional discharge, and that won't impose any burden on the presidency, which is what the court's concerned about in this immunity decision.
Yeah. And
so by signaling that, he, I think, you know, may have headed off a Supreme Court stay, which would have prevented him from conducting the sentencing at all.
And I want to get to the Supreme Court in a moment. But here's my complaint about Mershon's calls near the end of the case. And I agree throughout. It was remarkable that he was able to hold this case together, hold himself together throughout. But, you know, during the campaign, at Trump's request, Mershon, as you noted, put off the scheduling in the sentencing in July. It was scheduled, put it off until after Election Day, which meant that when Trump won, he had to change what he had otherwise planned on doing, sentencing him after the election. Why not sentence him before the election and then, you know, either change the sentencing later if needed or allow the appeals court to do so? Wouldn't that have been a smarter call for Mershon?
Yeah, I think you can argue that either way. I mean, I don't think that's an unreasonable position, but I also don't think the judge's decision was unreasonable because he was looking at it again. It wasn't a question at that point of interfering with Trump's presidential duties. Mm-hmm. You know, the question at that point was, will it be seen as trying to interfere with the election itself? If I let the sentencing go forward before the election, can that be seen as an attempt to influence the election by having him sentenced prior to November 4th? And he was trying to, out of an abundance of caution, avoid even the perception that the court was involved in trying to influence that. And then the corollary to that is what he said in his order now when he went forward with the sentencing. He said, look, this was postponed at Trump's request.
Yeah.
And at the same time, Trump was saying, I'm going to win the election. So you can't come in now and say, you can't sentence me when you know, you've sort of almost waived that argument, right? You asked for it to be delayed till after the election. And at the same time, you were saying, I'm going to win the election. So that suggests you knew, you know, that after the election and after you won, we'd be back here doing the sentencing. So he was able to kind of turn that back on Trump as a way to deny his request to avoid the sentencing altogether.
Well, of course. And we know that Trump is going to do that anytime. That's why I say, you know, sentencing and let him yell and scream that it's election interference all he wants. And if they want to, the appeals court or the Supreme Court wants to throw it out after the election for any reason, let him do it. That was my largely only quibble with Mershon here, that it feels like he should have gone ahead with it, even if it was seen as, you know, election interference or claimed to be election interference by Trump, which, by the way, he claimed it was election interference anyway.
He claimed it anyway, of course.
Even though he put it off. So, right. By the way.
But, you know. Yeah. Part of that, are you sort of assuming that the death sentence would have been the same as well? I mean, because, you know, in July.
Yeah.
It wasn't clear that it would have had to have been an unconditional discharge.
Right.
And he could have tried to put him in jail.
Yeah. No.
And then you are talking about real potential concerns about, you know, cutting off his campaign, and that would almost have certainly been appealed. It would just be a whole nother legal mess about imposing the sentence that was taking place during the campaign, and he just thought it was best for the legal system and for the case to avoid even the perception of that kind of interference.
Yeah.
I don't think that's unreasonable, but I don't think your position's unreasonable either.
Yeah, and I don't think his call is unreasonable either. I would have preferred to see it another way, but I do get it. You know, along those lines, would you characterize Trump's attorney's approach to this case as masterful as well, given that in the end he got off with everything, you know, he got away with everything, but, you know, a slap on the wrist and an official notice of being a felon on his criminal record. As dopey as they were, seems like they got him there.
I don't think his attorneys get too much credit for that. I don't think they did a very good job at the trial. And the sentencing is just a consequence of him winning the election, not a consequence of anything they did. You know, if he'd not won the election, then all options would have been on the table for the sentencing. So the fact that he is now walking free with no significant sentence is just because he won the election. It's not because of some brilliant legal strategy by his attorneys.
By the way, does this at the very least, because I'm trying to scrape something out of this, Randall, does this at the very least mean that he will lose his right to vote in the state of Florida as a convicted felon, which seems to be the case as far as I can tell?
Right. I think that's true, but I'm not a Florida legal expert. Yeah. And I read somewhere there's some provision where the governor can make an exception, you know, so you would expect. I mean, given the politics in Florida, even if that does normally take place, maybe they'll make an exception for him. But yeah,
there's also
a firearm.
He can't own a firearm. Okay. There's also a number of countries, including, as I understand it, Israel, Japan, New Zealand, the UK, and Canada, which prohibit entry by felons. Do you suspect they will find a way around those regulations for the president?
Yeah, I think that depends on the circumstances, of course. And I'm sure the countries have the option to waive that if they want to for the president of the United States. But on the other hand, if somebody doesn't want him to visit, maybe that's a great excuse, right? So, hey, sorry.
Yeah, we believe in the rule of law here.
Sorry, Don. Sorry, sir. You can't come. Yeah. We'd love to have you, really.
Yeah, really. But, you know, we got laws here, unlike the United States, apparently. Randall Elizin, you wrote over the weekend that Mershon's, quote, advance signal that he would sentence Trump to an unconditional discharge was critical to convincing the Supreme Court not to intervene. And indeed, as you noted, the Supreme Court, in their brief comments rejecting Trump's last minute emergency appeal here, mentioned that very point, that the sentencing could move forward in part because Trump was likely to be given no penalty that would impinge on his pre-presidency, I guess. But that troubles me as well. Trump lost, as you noted, just by one vote on the high court, a 5-4 ruling. It was as if the New York judge had to sort of promise, I'll give no actual penalty, in order for SCOTUS to agree to let it move ahead. But shouldn't they have allowed it to move ahead no matter the sentencing and then take action if they found the sentence was a problem impinging on his duties as president or something? I mean, it's as if they were saying, OK, he can be sentenced as long as he's given zero sentence.
Yes. And like I said, I think the fact that Mershon signaled that is what probably saved the Supreme Court from granting a stay. But you're right. The better course would have been for them to say, go ahead with sentencing. If Mershon tries to lock him up, then come back to us and say, OK, you can't lock him up because he's being sworn in 10 days. Right. Mm-hmm. And then we can deal with it then. But we don't need to sort of have this preemptive idea that, OK, you can go forward because he basically promised that there won't be any significant penalties. But, you know, I mean, given the way the vote went, it seems like a good thing Mershon did that. I mean, the fact that it was 5-4 is actually one of the more discouraging things about this whole story to me, is the idea that there were four justices who were basically willing to say, you know, we'll vote with Trump on this so he doesn't have his feelings hurt, you know, because there is no meaningful impact. There's clearly no meaningful impact on the presidency or on his duties. You know, he's got time to play golf. He can hop on a Zoom call for half an hour and go to his sentencing.
Right.
But they were still willing to go for it. And in a state court proceeding based on events that took place before he was president, to agree with him and say, oh, you can't be sentenced on this because you're going to be president in 10 days. I mean, it was just it's nonsense. And even if you think Thomas and Alito are a lost cause and they'll just vote for Trump anytime, which seems to be the case, the fact that Kavanaugh and Gorsuch also went along with it is not a good sign for the future.
No.
And I've got like four solid votes that seem to be willing to let Trump do pretty much anything he wants. And, you know, that wasn't really true in the first term. In the first term, they turned him down a fair number of times when it came to things like turning over his tax records and things like that. The Roberts Court was not always in Trump's camp during his first term, but this is not a promising start to the second term.
No, it wasn't, especially since they could have denied him here and then allowed him off the hook because, you know, he's going to appeal even the get out of jail free card that he received. He's going to appeal that. And so they could have let him off down the hook, you know, let him off the hook down the line if they needed it. But they signaled clearly they were, as you said, Thomas, Alito, Gorsuch, and Kavanaugh were all willing to go along with pretty much this outrageous appeal in advance. Now, you cite Justice Amy Coney Barrett, who joined with Chief Justice John Roberts in joining with the court's three liberals. You said Justice Barrett's joining was very interesting. How so?
Well, she's got an independent streak that Kavanaugh and Gorsuch aren't showing. So of the three Trump appointees, you know, she's not consistently falling in line with Thomas and Alito. She, in addition to this vote, you know, where she joined the chief and turning Trump down for the stay, she, in the immunity decision, although she did vote for immunity, she wrote a separate opinion and said the majority went further than it had to. And she said it should have been, you know, narrower. In the obstruction case about January 6th, where the court narrowed that statute as applied to the Capitol rioters, she wrote a dissent saying the statute should apply to the Capitol rioters. And that was joined by Kagan and Sotomayor, you know, the two most liberals, most liberal justices on the court now, I think. So, you know, she's of the Trump appointees, she's a conservative, but she has an independent streak. She has, I think, some consistent conservative principles that she adheres to. And as a result, she's not just always buying just because Trump wants it. She's not willing to do it. And, you know, that's an encouraging sign
for the moment.
She's feeling the heat. I don't know if she reads. I assume she probably doesn't look at social media, but MAGA on social media was just crucifying her after this. I mean, just, you know, calling her a traitor and circulating memes with her wearing Satan horns and, I mean, all kinds of stuff. So,
really?
Yeah, she's interesting to watch. She's much less predictable than some of the other conservatives.
We will see. So, Randall, what happens now with this Trump case? Essentially, the last one standing of the four he was charged with over the past 4 years. He's vowed to appeal the verdict, even though it's, you know, he got off scot-free. Shouldn't he just take the win and move on at this point rather than keep reminding the world through his court filings that he's a convicted felon?
Well, I think you could make that argument for sure. But I think what that highlights, again, is the fact that just the label convicted felon means something.
Yeah.
Not just to history, but to him. And I think to most people, you know, he's going to appeal to try to get that stigma removed.
Does he have any chance? Is there any chance that it'll be overturned? I mean,
I think so.
Really?
Yeah.
On what basis?
Yeah. I think there might be some legal question about, and it's kind of a technical statutory question about intent to defraud. This particular law requires not only that the records were false, but that you falsified them with the intent to defraud. And because it's a private company, and the records weren't meant to be shown to anybody else, and in fact were not shown to anybody else, I think there's legal argument that that intent to defraud is absent. I mean, I don't know if it'll win, but I don't think it's frivolous. And, you know, he'll pursue his regular appeals through the New York state court system, first the appellate division and then the New York Court of Appeals, which is their Supreme Court, just like any other criminal defendant. And he'll make those kinds of arguments, as well as arguments about errors he claims Mershon made during the trial, things like that.
And here's what I'm wondering, and as I'm, you know, reaching for anything I can hang on to here, Randall, if the New York Court of Appeals finds in a year or two, as this process plays out, that there was some error in the prosecution's case or in the trial, can they order a new trial? And if so, can he be retried, found guilty again, but this time sentenced to actual jail time, since by then his second term might be coming to a close? In other words, should I hope that he is successful on appeal, Randall?
No.
No?
I don't think so. Because, I mean, if that happened, yes, they could order a new trial, but they're not going to be allowed to put him on trial while he's the sitting president.
Right.
So now you're talking about going to trial in 2030,
okay,
2029, maybe.
I'm okay with that.
okay with that. All right.
Yeah.
And that assumes, you know, the DA can put on the case when it's then 12, 13 years old, and that there's the appetite to do that, and all the witnesses are still around, and, you know, that's the longest of long shots.
Well,
convict him a second time and then sentence him again. Yeah.
Like I said, I'm reaching for whatever I can here. in some other related-ish news, Very quickly here, we learned over the weekend that Special Counsel Jack Smith quietly resigned as special counsel from the federal cases, though I believe that was expected. He reportedly delivered a 2-volume report on his 2 investigations and indictments against Trump, both of which he apparently determined that he was forced to abandon post-election, both of those cases. And now the 1 volume has been released. We're waiting to see the 1 volume focused on Trump's attempt to steal the 2020 election. That has been released. We're now waiting to find out if there will be a release of the other case, the volume reporting on the other case, his stolen thousands of pages of highly classified national security documents that he stole when he left office the first time. But Merrick Garland has signaled he's going to hold off on releasing that volume because the case against Trump's 2 co-conspirators in that case is moving forward. So I'm wondering, A, shouldn't Garland just drop the cases against those 2 co-conspirators in order to release the full Smith report? And if not, should Joe Biden simply release the entire thing, whether it's a violation of law or not, since Supreme Court determined that a president can violate pretty much any law that he wants in the course of his official acts as president? I mean, what, if anything, would you expect here should be done or will be done at this point?
So I have argued that at this point, Garland should just drop the case against the other 2 for that reason, right? Because then there's no longer any argument about why you shouldn't release that voluminous misreport. And nobody thinks the case is going to be pursued once Trump's in office anyway. Of course, it's going to be dropped as soon as Trump's attorney general takes over. So why the charade that, oh, this is an ongoing case, and so we need to keep this stuff secret? Yep. So I think that would be a good idea. If that doesn't, I'm assuming that probably won't happen. And I think the reason is just that the Justice Department thinks as an institution, it needs to pursue this appeal because of Judge Cannon's ruling that special counsels are unconstitutional. And they don't want to they don't want to let that stand, right? And if that's going to be dropped, it's going to be up to the Trump administration to do it. They're not going to drop it and say, okay, we're okay with this ruling. So I think that's the reason.
This norms and traditions and institutionalism stuff is killing us, Randall.
Well, that's why Biden won't do what you're saying, right? Yes, theoretically he could do that and it would be an official act and he would personally be immune, but he'd be violating a court order. Currently Cannon has issued an order not to do it. And, you know, one party still has to believe in law and order and obeying court orders and following the rules. And, you know, I don't want Democrats to become like Trump. So I think it's a good thing that Biden doesn't order SEAL Team 6 to take him out or ignore a court order and release this report in violation of the law. And it'll come out someday.
Someday.
The truth has a way of coming out, right? It may not be right away, but it'll be within the Justice Department files. When there's a Democratic administration, if not before, they can release it. If it makes its way to Democratic senators, it'll see the light of day at some point. I'm confident.
At some point. Well, I'll tell you, my mother over the holidays, I was complaining about Democrats and their norms and traditions following. And she said, yeah, it's like hopes and prayers for Republicans, all of which seems to get us nowhere. By the way, I know you've been on the road for much of the day, but very quickly, in about 30 seconds, if possible, I suspect we'll have 4 years to talk to you about it. But Pam Bondi, her hearing, her oversight hearing in the U.S. Senate for her nomination played out throughout the day. She wouldn't answer any questions, pretty much, by and large. What are your hopes, fears, concerns about your beloved Department of Justice moving forward now in this new administration?
Well, I didn't have a chance to watch any of the hearing.
She was fantastic. I mean, you'll enjoy it. You'll enjoy it.
I know, you know, one of the concerns that's been raised about her is that she was sort of part of the big lie back in 2020. She was making claims about alleged voter fraud in Pennsylvania and things like that had no factual basis. So that's obviously concerning. I mean, the flip side is people that knew her and worked with her in Florida say that, you know, She's a serious person, and they thought she did an okay job as the Attorney General there for the most part. So I don't know. I think on the scale of Trump's nominees to various departments, she's on my list of concerns, maybe number 7 or 8.
Oh, boy.
I mean?
Yeah, I do. Well,
the bigger picture concern is the threats that Trump has made to use the Justice Department to go after political opponents and those who criticized him and people that ran the House January 6th investigation and things like that. I mean, that is obviously fundamentally wrong, a violation of everything the Justice Department stands for. And if those kinds of things do start to happen, then that's going to be a major, major deal. And that's one of my biggest concerns is, you know, whether Trump says a lot of stuff that he never follows through on, and we're all used to that by now. But if his Justice Department, which is, you know, going to have some of his personal trial attorneys apparently in top positions, if they do start using the justice system to go after his political opponents and those who criticize him, then that's going to be a huge, huge problem.
Yeah, well, if she's a serious person, just wait until you get a load of some of her her testimony on Wednesday in her hearing, and she was in fact asked about going after Trump's perceived enemies. I think we have a major, major deal ahead of us, Randall, but that'll give us something to talk about over the next few years. Randall Eliason, his work can be found at sidebarsblog.com, where he has a Substack newsletter you can and should sign up with. He is also on the Blue Skies now at R.D. Eliason. He is the former chief of fraud and, of the Fraud and Public Corruption section at the U.S. Attorney's Office for the District of Columbia. He now teaches white-collar criminal law at George Washington University Law School. Randall, always an honor to speak with you. Thanks for joining us again today.
All right. Thank you. Stay safe out there.
Yeah, and back at you. All right, we have got to get out. My thanks as well to Desi Doyen.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Desiree, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show, you can, of course, download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. Our ability to make that available to you is thanks to those of you kind enough to hit a donate button when you stop by, or go straight to bradblog.com/donate to support this important program over your public airwaves. Drop me an email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com, and you'll find me on the social medias, especially Blue Sky at the Brad Blog. We'll see you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
Listening to the Bradcast. We are 100% listener supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.